Good evening there. Okay, I think we're ready to get started. Thank you everybody for coming out and thank you for your patience. We are very excited to have our guest this evening, Marjorie Agosin, who's going to be speaking to us about her experiences as a Jewish Latin American writer. First, I want to acknowledge all the co-sponsors of this event, besides the libraries. Co-sponsors are the MSU Jewish Studies Program, the Global Studies in the Arts and Humanities Program, the Center for Gender in Global Context, CLACS, the Center for Latin American and Caribbean Studies, and the Department of Spanish and Portuguese. My name is Mary Jo Zeter. I'm the Latin American and Caribbean Studies Specialist here in the library. And on behalf of the libraries, we want to welcome our guests and Rocio Quispe, who will be introducing her. So briefly, let me tell you who Rocio Quispe is. She is the director of MSU's Center for Integrative Studies in the Arts and Humanities and associate professor of Colonial Latin American Studies in the Department of Spanish and Portuguese. Her research interests include Spanish American colonial literatures and cultures, Spanish American indigenous literatures and cultures, and Latin American historical narratives. Professor Quispe Anoli has published numerous scholarly articles and book chapters on themes of race, ethnicity, identity, and gender studies. Her book, entitled La Fe Andina en la Escritura, Resistencia e Identidad en la Obra de Guamán Poma de Ayala, which means Andean Faith in the Script, Resistance and Identity in the Works of Guamán Poma de Ayala, was published in Lima by the University Nacional Mayor of San Marcos in 2006. In addition to all her scholarly work, Professor Quispe is also a prize-winning author of short fiction. Her stories have been published in anthologies and periodicals, including in one anthology edited by our guest, Professor Agosin, Writing Toward Hope, the Literature of Human Rights in Latin America. And in 2008, her own volume of collected stories called Durmiendo en el Agua, Sleeping in the Water, was published. So please join me in welcoming Professor Quispe, and have a good evening.
Thank you very much. It is my pleasure today to introduce my colleague and friend, Marjorie Agosin, whom I met several years ago in a visit that I made to Wellesley College. At the time, Marjorie, who was already a well-known figure as a writer, critic, and human rights activist, gave me a warm welcome in Wellesley and her home. Marjorie has visited MSU in the past, and I am very pleased to welcome her again this evening. She's not only a great poet and an admirable human rights activist, but also a warm, sensitive individual who welcomes you in her circle and, most importantly, does listen to your ideas, inquiries, and concerns. I must now complement my personal introduction of Marjorie with a more formal and professional one. Marjorie Agosin was born in Maryland and raised in Chile. She and her parents, Moises and Frida Agosin, moved to the United States due to the overthrow of the Chilean government by General Pinochet's military coup. Coming from a South American country and being Jewish, Agosin's writings demonstrate a unique blending of these cultures. In 1982, she completed her PhD at Indiana University and became professor of Spanish at Wellesley College, where she teaches courses in Spanish language and Latin American literature. In addition to her work as a professor of Spanish, Marjorie Agosin is an award-winning poet and a well-known spokesperson for the plight and priorities of women in third world countries. She has authored almost 20 books of poetry and memoir and has also edited numerous anthologies dedicated to Latin American women writers. Her 1987 book, Scraps of Life, Chilean Arpilleras, tells of Chilean women who make their struggles known to the world through the exposition of arpilleras, folk tapestries which tell of their bravery and hardships in the face of oppression. Money from the sale of these handicrafts aids them in supporting families in which the men have been arrested, murdered, or have simply disappeared. Her concern for women in Chile has also been the focus feature articles in the New York Times, the Christian Science Monitor, Mrs. Magazine, and the Barnard Occasional Papers on Women's Issues. In her collection of bilingual poems, Dear Anne Frank, Agosin shares a remarkable imaginary relationship with this Jewish girl who perished in a concentration camp during World War II. In Uncertain Travelers, Agosin tells stories from multiple points of views that chronicle how her refugee European family acclimated to the unfamiliar territories in Chile. These stories are complex and discuss the difficulty of traveling for Jews between the years 1939 to 1970. Two books that reflect her close connection to her parents and family are Always from Somewhere Else, A Memoir of My Chilean Jewish Father, and A Cross and a Star, Memoirs of a Jewish Girl in Chile. In Always from Somewhere Else, Agosin remembers her late father, Moises. His life reflected the lives of many Jewish men. He was a doctor, a scientist, and a classical pianist. The memoir explores the boundaries of national and cultural identities. In A Cross and a Star, Memoirs of a Jewish Girl in Chile, a mother and daughter narrate this beautifully written memoir. Agosin exposes the tremendous anti-Semitism that erupted during World War II and while capturing the outstanding beauty of the southern tip of the world and the painful memories of a sensitive Jewish girl growing up among Nazi colonizers. In recognition of her deep social concerns and accomplishments, Marjorie Agosin received a Good Neighbor Award in 1988 at the 31st Annual Award Celebration hosted by the Northeastern Region of the National Conference of Christians and Jews. In 1995, she received the Letras de Oro Prize for Poetry, presented by Spain's Ministry of Culture and the North-South Center of the University of Miami to a writer of Hispanic heritage living in the United States. The Letras de Oro, Letters of Gold, recognizes both the creativity of the recipients and the importance of Spanish language in the United States today. This year, she also won the Latino Literature Prize for Poetry, awarded by the Latin American Writers Institute. This prestigious prize was awarded for her book, Toward a Splendid City. In 1998, she was honored by the United Nations for her human rights work. In 2002, she has been recognized by the government of Chile with a Gabriela Mistral Medal of Honor for Life Achievements and nominated for the Neustadt Prize for World Literature in 2003 and 2005. Among her recent titles, we have At the Threshold of Memory, New and Selected Poems, 2003, Cartographies, Meditation on Travel, 2004, Memory, Oblivion, and Jewish Culture in Latin America, 2005, Secrets in the Sand, The Young Women of Juarez, 2006, Writings Toward Hope, 2006, Tapestries of Hope, the Arpillera Movement in Chile, 2008, and The Light of Desire, La Luz del Deseo, 2009. Thanks to the sponsorship of the MSU Libraries, the Jewish Studies Program, Global Studies in the Arts and Humanities, the Center for Latin American and Caribbean Studies, and the Department of Spanish and Portuguese, and to the organizational effort of our colleague, Professor Maria Mudrovsic, Marjorie Agosin will talk today about Beloved Memory, A Writer's Journey Through Jewish Latin America. Welcome, Marjorie.
First of all, I appreciate all of you waiting for us to arrive. It seems we were traveling from a very far away part of the world, but it was only Ann Arbor. And it was raining, and I truly want to thank my friend Vivi for bringing me here. She deserves a clap, an applauso. And it's very special for me to be here with her as a We have known each other since kindergarten. And we went to the same school, to the Instituto Hebreo, the Hebrew Institute in Santiago, Chile. Then our paths separated and we have reunited a few years ago. We've lived in different parts of the world. And it seems we were still talking and playing in their school yesterday. And I'm very happy to be here, to see you, Rocio, again, to see Maria. I thank all the sponsors for this invitation. And I believe I was here in 2003. So I am back here again to Michigan State, and I'm very pleased to see so many people that we are interested in the subjects of literature and memory. I don't like to repeat myself, and I don't want to speak to you about the same things I spoke about in Ann Arbor, but in Ann Arbor I spoke about the concept of memory and literature and human rights. And today I will speak to you about something that it's very dear for me, because it has to do with the way in which I have been able to write intimate memories about my own family. So first, and then I will first of all kind of give you an idea and situate my talk, then I'll read a little bit, and then I hope very, very much to have a conversation. I was born in the United States by an accident of faith. My parents were living here, and when I was 3 months old, we all moved to Santiago, Chile, and we traveled from New York City in a boat, in a liner that doesn't exist anymore, called the Grace Liner, and I arrived to the port of Valparaíso together with my parents and my older sister, who was also born in the United States. It is interesting that I mention this because for me, Valparaíso, it's the point of arrival for all my stories, and I talk about stories, all my narratives, that could also include poetic narratives, because this is the port where all my family arrived from different parts of the world to Chile. So in this, and we were having these discussions this morning in Ann Arbor, in this very hybrid society, in this very nomadic world, and in this very mobile world, I have chosen to be rooted, even though I no longer live in Chile. But to me, I am so tired of being a nomad, because this has been almost the history of Jewish people. I want to be settled in a place. And the only place I feel safe and that I can be settled is the place of memory. And the place of memory begins in Chile, in the Spanish language, and in a very important port, especially in the 19th century, early 20th century, and a little bit now, which is Valparaíso, the farthest port of South America. Most people that emigrated to the Southern Cone arrived to the port of Buenos Aires. I grew up in a family that spoke many languages. Spanish was an acquired language, but it was my own language, and it is my native language. But they spoke Yiddish, they spoke German, they spoke Ladino, and they spoke Russian. And I think the multiplicity of languages gave me a tremendous possibility of understanding what it meant to travel, understanding the idea of voyages, culture, and imagination. But at the same time, I always knew that I was very much rooted in Spanish. I think I became a poet because I think one doesn't really not choose to be an artist. It's almost impossible to choose it somehow. There is a powerful intuition or desire that you want to be a poet, or you want to be a teller of stories. But I think for me, not only this desire became very real, but I also grew up with relatives who were wonderful fabuladores, those that spoke in fables, those that always told stories, those that always share the stories about how they arrived to Chile. And for example, one story that also appears in many of my writings is the arrival of my grandmother, Josephine, but her name was not Josefina. She and her parents, when she was about 3 months old, took a transatlantic train from Buenos Aires to Mendoza, which is a very beautiful Andean city in Argentina. And from Mendoza, she took she and her parents, as she was a baby, arrived to Chile in a mule. So this, all of these ideas that I heard as a young girl crossing the Andes in a mule, they were amazing, amazing stories that almost 30 years later appeared in books. But what's interesting about my grandmother was that her name, when she was born in Buenos Aires, her name was Hannah. But the Chilean officials said, Hannah, I don't know what you're talking about. He said, they never knew that you could actually write a name with an H. And they said, Hannah, we are going to name her Josefina. And this is how she became Josefina. She loved, I didn't bring some poems about her, but she loved Chile. She thought that it was dreadful to live in the United States because people ate here too early. She always says she cannot eat at 5 o'clock. And sometimes I find myself thinking, I don't want to have my dinner at 5 o'clock either. I think I'll just have a cup of coffee and wait till 8, till it gets dark. But again, my grandmother was so, so rooted at home. And she had no desire to ever leave her country that was not the country of her birth. The other story that I think it's important because also it appears on the book is the story of my grandfather, Joseph, Josefina's husband. And it just happens he was named Joseph, and you know, she was named Josefina, but really she was named Hannah. And this is an interesting story because my grandfather was a dreamer. We always call him Don Quixote. He had a great sense of adventure, and they belong to a very well-to-do Viennese family, and he was in love with a cabaret dancer. And his mother, Helena, thought that was a very dangerous liaison, so my grandfather looked at a map and said, I am going to travel and get off at the last spot of the world. Look at them. This was 1929. And the last spot of the world happened, you already guessed, happened to be Chile and happened to be the port of Valparaíso. But also the fact that he traveled to such a remote country, and I still, even though we have planes and communications, I still find it a very far away place. I thought that providence and faith and luck work on his favor, because in 1939, he was able to negotiate visas, paying a tremendous amount of money that he never had. He worked in a German chocolate factory that made cookies called Hucke, but he managed to bring his own mother and my uncle to safety in 1939. And that is the only family from his side, and of course my family, that survived the Holocaust. All of the rest perish in Auschwitz, and they perish in Terezin. But again, the point of arrival was Chile. And the last story I'd like to share you with this is about my other grandfather, my father's father, who did not come from you know, from Central Europe, you know, that among Jews is considered to be, you know, the aristocracy of Jews, the German Jews, the Austrian Jews. He was Ukrainian. He lived in Sevastopol. His wife, my grandmother, lived in Odessa. Of course, they were extremely poor. The only trade that a Jew could have was to be a tailor or fight in the army of Tsar Nicholas, and he fought in the Russian army for 25 years. And then this is how I think the world has its way of paying people for their loyalty. He had to escape. The programs began to arrive, and he had an amazing journey, which my husband and I did about 3 years ago. We recreated their journey, which was from Odessa to, I may not give you the right order, the exact order, but it was Odessa, Bulgaria, Romania, and Istanbul. And contrary to what people may think, I think that Istanbul is an amazingly Jewish city, because so many Jews, from after they were expelled from Spain, went to the Ottoman Empire and went to Istanbul. And from Istanbul, they walked. And it's not so difficult to walk because you walk around the Black Sea, and the journey, ours took, of course, much less because we had cars and boats, but their journey took about 2 months. And from that journey, they arrived from Turkey. They also walked to Marseille, where my father was born, and then again from Marseille to the port of Valparaiso. And I want to share with you all of these absolutely true stories so that you will situate these people and their tremendous voyages. Then, I mean, here you can go any part of the world for less than even China, from Detroit to China or to Beijing or to Tokyo in less than 24 hours, but those journeys and the boat and the carriage and also the unknown. So to me, as a very young girl, I understood their heroism, but I didn't understand their silences. I didn't understand the mystery of so many things they refused to speak about. And my task as a writer is to speak about that mystery and to speak about that silence. Now, when did I become a Jewish writer? And I think, unfortunately, this North American society categorizes people. Now I'm like a Latino Jewish writer. For other people, some person that doesn't like me learns stuff and thinks that I'm not a Latino writer, and everybody says, you are not in his huge encyclopedia, but then somebody else says, who reads encyclopedias? So anyway, the thing is, when I never thought of myself as a Jewish writer. I always thought of myself as a Latin American writer. My poetry always spoke about the theme of the disappeared, about absence, about censorship. But at the same time, I think my concern for social justice and for naming those without a name and those that disappear without a trace, and especially my own generation, brought me closer to being a Jewish writer, because I became very aware that to write is to remember. And to write is to remember so many things that have been left unsaid. And that also you write against forgetting. There's a marvelous book by the American poet Caroline Forget that is called Against Forgetting. And the poetry is about war, atrocity, censorship, so that we will not forget. So I think my concern for this wonderful Talmudic concept, tikkun olam, to mend the world, brought me closer to what I think a Jewish writer is. And we may disagree about what a Jewish writer may be, We may disagree about the meaning of a Jewish state. Israel is one of the most hotly debated political topics in the news. But I do believe that there is a profound tradition of Jewish literature that begins with this amazing text that is called the Bible. And of course, from the Bible, we can move on to Hasidic literature, the literature of the shtetl, 19th century literature, the work of Levitas, the work of Kafka, Shalom Aleichem, Bialik, Agnon, David Grossman, modern Israeli writers, Jewish writers of Latin America, Margot Glantz, Isaac Goldenberg, and there is a body of Jewish writing. So this idea of becoming a witness and acknowledging silence, I think, brought me into the path of writing about Jewish themes and as a Jewish writer. And I will basically enumerate the books that, for me, are what I consider Jewish text. I think the first book I wrote, and this was my first, in a way I would say, departure from poetry and entering into prose. But it is always poetic prose because I believe that if you are a poet, you will always write as a poet, and you, and even your narratives will have that poetic voice. So, Across a Star, it's a first memoir book, and again, the whole idea that is also, I think, a very Jewish idea to create books of memory. Even the great books of Jewish thought are books of memory, like the Passover, Haggadah is about memory, or the oral tradition of Judaism, or the Mishnah, or the Talmud, or the rules about how to behave and how to be. I think they are all memorial books. So I wrote Across a Star because I wanted to understand, acknowledge, and memorialize the life of my mother in a particular time of history. And this is a point I would like to make, of course, and the title of today's talk is called Beloved Memory. Of course, I write about my beloved family, but I write about them because they were protagonists of world events. And if they weren't the protagonists of world events, I do not think I would have chosen them as a subject. But not only were they my family, but they were historical heroes and heroines. So this book, Across a Star, it's about the complex relationship between Jews in a very Christian world, which is the Latin American world, the Catholic world, but at the same time, the even more eerie, because I don't think the Christian was eerie, was just complex and often difficult, as it was very, very difficult for Catholics to accept those that were not baptized. And I think it was difficult because they were not even allowed to enter schools, their schools. But I wanted to also write about my mother's life in a German community, excuse me, in the south of Chile, a community that was completely pro-Nazi, that fought in the side of Hitler. Chile abstained during World War II. He never became an ally of the US. And what it was like for her to be the daughter of a German Jewish immigrant living in that community. So I think that book to me unfolded so many mysteries, especially how a country like Chile, a very Catholic country, treats its foreign immigrants, not only the Jews, and how the German communities were so powerful in the south of Chile and even remained to be even more powerful during Pinochet. But also, this is a book that I think opens a door to the world of memory. And I think this book opened a whole world for me as a writer because I learned so many complicated things about remembrance. I learned about how to write about things unsaid, how to write about silences. My mother was almost my informant. I taped her, I recorded her, but I also had to interpret the things she didn't say and the things she didn't remember. And at the same time, this little book that was published in Spanish called A Sacred Memory was first published in Chile and then in English under a cross and a star was filled with contradictions in the sense that the Jewish community did not like this book because it exposed Chilean antisemitism, and it's there. And I think even now, with all my love for Chile, antisemitism is rampant, and the leaders of Jewish communities are threatened quite often. But this is also something very hushed. I also thought that the German communities of Chile did not like how the book, how they were portrayed, because they were portrayed as racist, not only in the relationship to the four Jewish families, but in the relationship to the Indian communities around them. So memory, it's always questionable, debatable, and incredibly political. But I was interested in creating a hybrid text where the historical and the personal and the intimate would create a book of art. And I think that to me was a challenge and an apprenticeship to go on and to think about other books and other stories. And after I wrote about my mother, I felt I had to write about my father as if I would memorialize him and immortalize him in two books, two lives. And I've always believed that literature, especially when you write about memory and healing, it almost becomes a sacred experience. So then I recounted my father's life in a book called Always from Somewhere Else, which is the book about a wandering Jew, a nomadic Jew, a person that doesn't fit really in the world and at the same time fits in all worlds. And I think my father had an interesting journey or trajectory from a Chilean physician to a Jewish Chilean physician to a third world, because this is how he was called when he arrived to the United States, to Georgia, a third world scientist in the United States. But also I've learned the inability, and I think this was his greatest grief, but perhaps his greatest privilege, the inability to fully belong. And I think this is the Jewish experience, the inability to belong truly to a place. And I think Jewish thought, Jewish people, in a way, we belong more to books, to ideas, than to geography. And I would even take this idea further, that Israel is more than a geography. It's a metaphor, it's a symbol, and I think we also have to look at it that way. So after that, I journey into a book about Anne Frank that Rosario mentions, which is a conversation with Anne Frank, not as a victim of the Holocaust, but as a writer. And I tried to create a conversation with her, and I tried to make her more real. Then I wrote about my own work, my own life, but I am not that type of a person that will write about my life till now, till the things I've done now, because I think that to write your own memoirs, you have to be like 90 years old to really write. I think it's too pretentious. So I only wrote till I was 15. Because I felt that at 15, my life changed because I left Chile and I had to be a whole human being in another language. And the last book I wrote Well, there are two more. One is called the Angel of Memory, which is the journey of my great-grandmother, Helena, the one that arrived to the port of Valparaíso in 39 to Chile. And I try to also create a geography between the old world, the old Europe, and the new world. And my last book that to me it's important is called The Light of Desire, La Luz del Deseo. And this book is a love poem. It's one poem divided in four cantos. It's a meditation on love and the possibilities of love in a very contested place, Israel, the city of Jerusalem. But it's also somehow, because of its of the language and because I myself, a woman that wrote it, not an imitation, but perhaps another conversation with this great, almost universal, and of course Jewish text, which is the Song of Songs, one of the most beautiful collections of Hebrew poetry ever written by King Solomon. I have never wanted ever to play this very easy anti-Semitic ticket or this very racist ticket, because I believe you. I want to give credit to people. I think we are much more than our bigotries and our biases. But I have learned that when it comes to the subject of Israel, no one is spared, because people and critics, and they say it publicly in the internet, are very upset that I wrote about Israel as a place of love and possibilities. And I think it is very shameful that one would not enter a text with openness and would put their political biases. And I've learned quite a bit that you cannot, that so many people cannot accept that one would be engaged with Israel for whatever politics you are involved, the left, the right, the middle. So that to me has been very revealing. But this book is about peace. There's hardly any mention of war. And it's called The Light of Desire because I look at desire as effort, the desire as a place of possibilities to understand those that are not like our own. What I'd like to do now, and I don't want to like keep you here forever, and I would like for you to ask questions, I will just read you a few segments from these books, and just now that you've seen the geographical journey, I will take you more into the poetic journey. I'll read about 10 minutes, and then we could just have a conversation. So, Maria, can you pass me my glasses and my books there?
Okay.
It's a heavy prayer. I'm not going to read and read and read, but. Eso, la cartera turquesa, yeah. As I begin just reading this text for you, also, I like to believe that a part of Jewish writing and part of Jewish history deals with impermanence. People moving from place to place, and I think, for me, the greatest impermanence and the greatest act of disappearances and was almost a culmination on Jewish history was the Holocaust. One of the holidays that I love the most is the holiday of Sukkot, where you create a tent with the harvest of the fruits, but you kind of have uneven walls and an open sky, because even homes are very, very frail. So I think I have always struggled against this frailness, against that vanishes. And I think that writing is permanence, even if, you know, maybe three people would read a book of poems. Unfortunately, this is the truth. But poetry remains And I think because it remains, it's also a sacred text. Okay, let me just, let's see. I'm not going to read you a bunch of them, but let me just, okay. I think I'll begin with the Angel of Memory. And it's the story of Helena Broder crossing the sea to arrive to safety to Chile and to never return to a burning Europe. And if you're interested in music or in theater, this her history, and this book has been made into a musical, and it's called The Angel of Memory. And you can see some of it, and they played in the internet. I do believe in angels, no matter how your definition of an angel is, but I like to believe in the symbolic idea that appears in the Hebrew Bible, that an angel is a messenger of good omens, a messenger of danger, and often, and if you begin to really think about Jewish mysticism or any kind of mystical aspect of the Judeo-Christian world, the angel is also a communicator between the dead and the living. So this poem is called, I Thought You Were an Angel, Helena. All of these poems have been written originally in Spanish and translated into English by different people. This is by Laura Nakazawa. I thought you were an angel, sensing your way along the corridors, a stranger among your own belongings. I thought you were an angel, praying while walking through empty hallways, perplexed lives and songs like soft prayers. It was you, my grandmother, wandering at night through your house of memory, writing words that glide into silence, delirious facing shadow rooms. Who were you looking for, so light and small, in your white nightgown with your tiny lantern? I thought you were an angel, and I played at discovering each one of your messages, messenger of intense life, of the frail memory, a gardener of nocturnal flowers. Helena Broder. I'll read this in Spanish and then in English because it's a briefer poem. Se llama Helena Broder, es mi bisabuela, perteneciente a un linaje de viajeros magos. Tan solo recuerdo una fecha, 1939, la noche en Hamburgo, sobre su estola de fuego. Nunca discutimos el linaje ni los objetos transitorios. La tentación era olvidar las cenizas, abrazar los espejos con el rostro encendido de amores. Eran precarias nuestras genealogías. Grandiosa la memoria. Her name is Helena Broder. She's my great-grandmother, belonging to a line of magician travelers. She only remembers one date, 1939, the night in Hamburg on her stole of fire. We never discussed lineages nor passing things. The temptation was to forget the ashes, to embrace the mirrors. Like ardent lovers, our precarious genealogies made memory magnificent. Now, the new world. 1939, in Spanish. Supo ella seducir al destino, vaticinar la hora de la huida. En 1939, vestida con el traje de noche y la dicha, en los umbrales del agrio puerto de Hamburgo, navegó resuelta la vida hasta los mares del sur. She knew how to deceive her destiny, how to predict the right moment to flee in 1939, dressed as if for an evening party, even on the frightening docks of the port of Hamburg, resolved to live, she set sail for the southern seas. I'll move now to some of the poems found in Dear Anne Frank. Anne Frank, under the sky of Bergen-Belsen, under the ashen stars, you appear head-shaven, distant, near, and you are more beautiful without hair. And your head gives off an incandescent perfume scent to frighten away death clicking heels. You are beautiful, Anne Frank. You go for a walk, proud and erect, covering yourself with the birds and the puppies. Anne Frank, was your hair as beautiful as azure waterfalls, loose, flowing, and fanciful? You brush it lovingly over your neck as over a grotto. When they shave your head, did anyone tell you you had beautiful hair? Did anyone safe keep your amber braids? Anne Frank and I are friends. Travelers on bewitched dark nights, she and I want to be writers or women who write. Anne is dead. I am alive. However we talk, during the restless and sobbing nights, she comes and I die next to her in a forest of ashes where nothing and no one grows. When I thought of her mute among the ashes, I also died. Anne Frank, I have loved you for a long time, looking for you. But you know, when I tell the other girls, your thousands of readers, they tell me the same thing. Maybe it is absolutely inexplicable that someone should love you, that they should not humiliate themselves before your memory with obsession, with elegance, with humbleness. They love you, Anne. Many of them carry you in their hearts, tucked under their arms. I, Anne, like you, am more than a Jewish girl. I am obsessed, and I have brought every edition of your diary, because above all, I must not let any of your words escape me. Anne, did words please you like rivers or abandoned cities? Anne, what did you do during so many silences? Anne, dear Anne, always I write you letters. They accumulate at the gates of heaven, because if there is a heaven, you are up there, all dressed in amber and violet, draped in moss and flowers. Your notebook has grown thick in heaven, as has your arm. In heaven, you have a mauve desk, and the drawers are filled with the names of girls both dead and living. Anne, dear Anne, bent over the divine house of God and the house of words, Anne Frank, I sleep with you and hug your life in my sleeplessness, and I name you, and you are alive, Anne, although I died while reading you. Now, two very brief ones from this memoir called The Alphabet in My Hands. And just something so that I'd like to share with you how, in a way, in Chile, we were able to grow in peace in a Catholic world, especially, of course, after the World War II was over. and how so many of the growing up as a Jewish girl, I also grew up knowing how to recite our father. I understood the superstitions of the maids that took care of us. But it was a very colorful world, a world of many possibilities, a world of great superstition, especially the Catholic world that I witnessed. But at the same time, a world where somehow, even though you didn't understand differences, you were able to love one another. So overall, it was, to me, and especially growing up in Chile, a very good world, different than the world of my parents. Passover. The table, as long as a map of distant lands, spreads before us children like a sovereign queen. Bouquets of white and mauve roses presided over the house, keeping the mirrors company, and my grandmother Helena smiling and dancing, slice apples into small pieces and mix them with nuts. This is Passover, she would say to me. This is the holiday of freedom, and I assume I could say forbidden words as well as polite ones, leave my hair uncombed, and lounge in a chair like a satisfied lady, because that was happiness. At Passover, we sang and gossip and whistle. From her kitchen of smoke and stars, Carmencita sang the Ave Maria and made the sign of the cross. For the sake of the heretic, she served with love. We felt less alone at Passover. The Haggadah contained illustrations similar to those in the books owned by the girls who live at the corner. Everything about Passover had the fragrance of violets, and then Easter week would arrive, and we would eat fish from the Pacific that, like unleavened bread, had come from the heavens. I don't know, Vivi, if you remember the Marconi Theater where the German Jews went. They rented a theater where the German Jews went to play. It's called the Marconi Theater. My grandmother was afraid of prayers, but she rabbled like a love-struck bird. She always said that the real paradise was here, on earth. And that's why I loved her, because she was mischievous and disorderly, because she read love letters out loud. On fast days, she used to become annoyed at all the gods, banners, and Carmen's virgins. As if pleasantly drunk, she ate ham and fried fish with exquisite indifference. My grandmother would say, "You ought to be ashamed, Josefina." My grandfather would say, "You ought to be ashamed, Josefina, on the holidays." She would look at him unmoved and continue savoring the sweet taste of her forbidden dinners. I, on the other hand, would draw near to grandfather, stealing my small hand into his enormous green coat and get ready to go out with him to the Marconi Theater, where the German Jews celebrated the holidays. My grandfather and I most often took a taxi and had the driver drop us off 5 blocks before the theater so that everyone else would think we had arrived on foot. I like to lie about such things because they were delicious and impressive lies, lies that adults told, not children. We would arrive at the Marconi Theater where the men smelled of confinement and bygone ages. This man greeted my grandfather in German, and he was thrilled to hear his own language. His language? The language that killed millions of Jews? But he was happy with so little. That was my grandfather, too good to be human. They called him the angel. I would sit on his lap, trembling with song and prayer. I am sure that he thought of his father in his solitary grave in the woods of Vienna, and he would beat his breast and pray for the angels, for the sparrows, for all his beloved dead, numbering more than 6 million, and for the Jews who were acknowledged only on feast days. My grandfather was like a resting place. His was the grace and gift of the enlightened, and I loved him and prayed for his dead in the Marconi Theater. Between prayers, the afternoon passed slowly, like random rainy days. We, the little Jewish girls, wink at one another, perch on our grandfather's laps. We exchange sweets, orange blossoms, the pleasing things of happiness. My grandfather would beat his breast and kiss me. We would go to a place beyond time, and the men and women would hug and say in German, "Alles Gute, alles schön." I would also repeat those words in that language which sounded wild to me. And feeling wild and dark myself, I yearned to go to tell Carmencita that I was surely seated among her saints. And the last one that I think is quite interesting because it's historically true is called The Jewish Dog. And the song I'm going to read you from appears in very old Spanish medieval literature. Even the teacher joined in ferociously and happily they sang this song. How many loaves in the oven? 21, all burned. Who burned them? The Jewish dog. These were the earliest rhymes full of ire and hatred that I heard in first grade in Santiago de Chile in 1962. The school was 4 long blocks from my home in the old neighborhood of Ñuñoa, where Chilean aristocrats used to stroll along lush avenues. After school, my mother usually picked us up and witnessed our distress. Aware of our Jewishness, my sister and I regularly cried tears of shame. The song I have mentioned is still sung today in many schools throughout Chile. My mother hears it in Osorno, my father hears it in Quillota, my friend Cristina hears it at the Polish-British school where her daughters are enrolled. There is no remorse, no compassion, on the contrary. When we confronted the teacher who enjoys singing the tune, she felt personally attacked. This is the sad solitude of my country. The common consciousness, any sense of responsible solidarity vanishes like a misty morning along the coast. We hang our heads as we walk home, and in the distance we hear someone mock us. There goes 2 Jewish dogs. My parents decided to send us to an old Jewish school where no one would sing that frightful song to us. To end, and I thank you for the patience of listening to me, and hope very much we'll have a conversation. 2 or 3 poems from La Luz del Deseo, The Light of Desire. Let's see. And again, this is one love poem. About Israel, the love of a man, the love of a place, and the love of God. The body decided to love. It had its reasons. It wanted freedom. Its knowledge was more diaphanous than the soul. It met its other body. Secretly, they exchanged stories. An arm spoke with the mouth. The mouth joined a leg. And thus, lightly as a dream of God, they loved, like water loves the sea that surrounds it. I love small things like your name, grand and secret. I love your traveling fingers in a caress, in the touching of air that gather fruits that ran through my hair. I love your heart that still beats like a startled child. I love the abbreviated words that you say to me, confused by the vastness of this love. I love the faces of your small children, so similar to yours. I love the intense night of Jerusalem like a rosy cloud. I love Israel, so sweetly small, We traverse it like we traverse our bodies in the suddenness of an instant, in the eternity of the desire, in the passion of history, of lives spilled from lives that always are born. I love when you tell me I am the wind's breath. I love the months of April when poppies cover Galilee, and May when sunflowers reflect your skin. I love small things like the love of a single night that envelops the dream of night. This is about Hebrew. I learned your language. I slowly repeat the first syllables, the beginning of the Aleph, all containing, like the immensity of love. I learn to say, see. And while my body repeats, see, it is a wave, a flame. I learn to write your language, mysterious Hebrew, calligraphies of fire and air over the letters. I like the letter I that rolls on my tongue and falls on yours. I like the S. S of silence, S of shalom. I learned your language while you teach me to say, your hair still inhabits the wind. Cleverly you seal my mouth with a kiss, like the light of silence. I learned your language. You kiss me in it after 17 centuries. In it, I love you. In it, you feel me. And to end, Let's see, it is. Here, the beginning of the book, and you could read it from the beginning or the end. Okay. Okay. Traviesa y despeinada te beso. Tus párpados, el sol ha dormido en ellos. Mi boca es tu luna. Uncombed and bold, I kiss your eyelids where the sun has slept. My mouth is your moon. While you embrace me, your arms are trees dancing to a willful wind. Mine are bent branches, fearless grasp. Encontré a Israel en tus ojos, a sus ríos en tu boca. I found Israel in your eyes, its rivers in your mouth. La luz de Israel, la luz de Jerusalén, tan clara, tan oscura, tan suave y ovalada, reposando sobre las piedras. Cierro los ojos, estás. The light of Israel, the light of Jerusalem, so clear, so dark, so soft, so oval, resting on the stones. I close my eyes. You are here. So I think I have shared with you a journey about beloved memory from Valparaíso to Jerusalem, sacred places and sacred geographies. I'm very honored that you're still here listening, and and I appreciate this because, you write alone, and it's a tremendous gift to be able to share it with people. And again, thanks, Rocío. Thank you, Maria. Thank you, Vivi. And I would really welcome, you know, any questions or thoughts or things that you would like to share. Yes.
I just want to share that my family got to Argentina, Buenos Aires, in 1941, escaped Italy. They're Jewish.
Yes.
And I found it all very interesting.
Thank you.
I wish I could write that again.
You can, I think all of us should try. You never know what will happen. But yeah, Argentina, even now, continues to be the biggest Jewish community of Latin America after Mexico. And there's quite a vibrant Jewish life. Thank you. Yes, yeah. Well, I think I think sometimes I overwhelmed my translator because I wrote faster than they could translate, and they were like tired. But I think I have like a group of. I feel that my translators are friends, and I don't know. I don't like to use this word, but people use it. I don't know if it's the right protocol or the right thing to do, but when somebody is so intimately engaged with the poem, or like the people that have translated the stories I wrote about my family, you know, I built a relationship with them. So I have a group of four or five, and I work with them, I participate in the process. But I don't know, now I think I have written so much bilingual, Spanish, English. I am ready now to write more in Spanish only, as I see myself maybe moving back to Chile and just writing in Spanish. I mean, I want my books to be translated into English. I live here. This is my home. But somehow I think I want to truly return to Spanish. And Spanish is the third most spoken language in the entire world. So I feel so privileged to write in such a language that so many people understand it. But it's complex, the whole idea of translations. There's a question in the back, yeah. I can't hear you. Can you speak loud? I have had some like the Anne Frank poems that I read. That book has been translated into Hebrew. I have another book called Maps of Love, translated into Hebrew. And I am especially happy that Anne Frank is translated into Hebrew and to see the book at Yad Vashem, the Holocaust Museum in Jerusalem. Yiddish, no. I would love to have my work, you know. Yiddish is a bit of a lost language now, but also marvelous revived by the work of, his name escapes me, but he created the Amherst Yiddish Center, where people from all over the world donated Yiddish books. And who knows, maybe, I think Yiddish is, it's going to come back to be spoken by more and more people instead of disappearing. So it will be wonderful. Yes.
I noticed in a couple of your readings and in the bit that I know about Jewishness that the mirror is very symbolic or has a lot of meaning. Can you explain that a little bit?
What I often refer to, and you're very perceptive within some of the readings, is when what is called the Shiva, when people die and you have the 7 days of mourning, you close the mirror, you put sheets over the mirrors, and it's very kind of scary and symbolic. And I always wanted to know why, because many rabbis have different interpretation, but in a way it's because so that you will not see your sorrowful face. And I think that's also quite beautiful that you cover it so that you will not see sorrow in the mirror. Mm-hmm. And also the idea that grief is something so internal that you should not look at your face. And as a child, I was struck by all, you know, every time people died in the family or friends, I noticed how the house was prepared with every single mirror cover, and that has haunted me. And maybe also you it could haunt you, because I think it's symbolically it's very powerful. Yes.
There was so many things came to my mind, but one of the things, when I think of Latin America, I think of food, and not a lot in terms of the memory. Wasn't mentioned. And the other thing that was interesting, since you brought up the subject of German, I was born in Crystal City, Texas. Texas, and that town was a concentration camp. A concentration camp for Japanese as well as for Latin American German. And to me that was really interesting, because when I tell people that my hometown, I'm running into maybe second or third generation folks. of Japanese ancestry or German ancestry who have this memory of these concentration camps. And it was really fascinating because I started looking into it a little bit more. And so the doors were open and people were said, you know, go home kind of thing. And so basically some of them went, some of them stayed. And you really don't know until you run into some of these individual oddities, especially Peruvian, Japanese individuals. But with the Germans, the only two countries that refused to send their citizens was Argentina and Bolivia. Mm-hmm. I just find it fascinating when you mention those countries in the context of the stories and some of the connections or stories or, you know, within the families, Germans that you mentioned in Chile. Mm-hmm. Are there memories of that? Are there, you know, of people being expulsed? And also, when I talked to one young lady who was born in that concentration camp, she was still very bitter that Latin American country, their countries, I mean, they saw them as their countries, they were, you know, removing them. I just wondered if you ever came across any of that in your relationships or in your talk.
I knew about the internment camps of the Japanese and the Germans in the U.S., but not of Latin American Germans. I didn't know that. But I know that Argentina and Bolivia were havens for Nazis. You know, Mengele lived in Brazil, in Bolivia, in La Paz, and Eichmann lived in Jerusalem, I'm seeing the trial. Eichmann lived in Buenos Aires like an ordinary citizen, and then he was caught by the Simon Wiesenthal and was taken to Jerusalem for a trial. So I am not surprised that Argentina and Bolivia did not extradite his German citizens, because they brought their, you know, even Juan Perón wanted their fortune. I don't know if Vivi, you want to comment about Chile or Maria, but Argentina.
I grew up in Argentina.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I'm Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
And I
yes.
To Argentina.
Yes. Yeah.
So we're taking both German and Jew.
Exactly.
You can't leave that part out.
Exactly.
Not just
Germans. Yeah. And that, I think, it's an amazing contradiction. You're right. They took Germans, but Nazis and Jews.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I don't know how much modern Argentina thinks about this or acknowledges. And I think this is a lot of problems and issue with Jewish history within Latin America, how much this is spoken about. In Chile, I know that there are some Nazis that also settled in Chile. One very notorious one, Walter Rauch, but I mean, Chilean society doesn't really talk about it. Yes, yeah.
Two questions, actually, one very quick. So wish I had a question, but then the second, if you have time. I read Pablo Neruda first in Farsi before coming to this country, if I come from Iran. I wish well, poetry is translated, if it's not already in Farsi, and also Arabic, so that I could share it with some other, there are some Jewish Farsi writing poets and blogs. So that's a wish, and please think about it. And
okay, Farsi is a language of poetry. Farsi is a beautiful language of poetry. So it would be wonderful, it would be an honor.
I assume that you had confronted this situation being a human rights activist, confronted some contradictions of the so-called radicals when it comes to the Jews, particularly after the Iranian Revolution. I have been most of my life a pro-radical. I remember that I participated in some of the student demonstrations for Ireland, and we loved him, and so on, and some other radicals, the Mumbai. So from after the Iranian Revolution, and I could never understand why some of the so-called radical left, their flirtation with radical terrorist Islam, especially Khomeini and Hamas and that kind of thing. Many times I tried to argue and understand that. I come from a Muslim background, so I was not at that time definitely a Jew also. Probably you confronted this, your colleagues, your comrades, probably. How did you deal with them? What is their argument? I could never understand why they should be as Marxist, Leninist, and so on, why they should be on the side of Khomeini or
You mean?
Especially when it comes to Israel, it seems.
Yeah, when it comes
to... Much more terrible anti-Semite than the normal ones.
You're right. I have confronted this, but in perhaps not in open discussions or dialogues, but in reviews of books. You mean how to confront the...
Could you have a CIA agent or something like that?
But yeah, no, but I understand how to confront maybe intellectuals that support radical Islamic groups, how to speak to them, you know, especially if... Yes, yeah. Well, you know something? It's a very complicated question, but in my own personal way, I have learned not to argue with a fanatic. So I withdraw. I will not argue with a fanatic Jew, a fanatic Muslim, a fanatic Christian. You cannot argue. And I learned that through conversations and through the writings of Amos Oz, a great, wonderful Israeli writer that I admire, and a peace activist, he says, you cannot argue with a fanatic, so I withdraw. So I've learned that, not to argue. But it's very frightening how people, and I used to be very much a person of the left in Chile, speak so ill of Jews and of Israel and support governments such as Hamas that punishes women, that rapes them, that stones them, that don't allow them to study. I wonder why they don't defend those women that spend their time arguing about the little devil that is Israel, because the big devil, they think it's America, so there's a little devil that is Israel. I wonder about that. And in a way, you know, I've come to also believe that this whole nonsense, really, of political correctness is a big lie. Because we have so many biases against certain people and against certain nations. There are so many people so ready to condemn others without knowing the facts. And Israel is a great place of condemnation. But I think the world, as we live in this country now, and everyone is so frightened of terrorism, whether it's real or not, but the fears are here, especially when you go into the airports. People will understand what it is like to be bombed every day, to have Katyushkas thrown to the children, to go to a cafe, and die. People will understand a little bit what it's like to be attacked by terrorism. And maybe this little Israel will not be a place of demonization, but it will be a place for democracy. And I'm hoping that people will see not the perfection of Israel, but people will see that Israel is a very, very strong democracy. And Hamas, it's a fundamentalist, fanatic regime, even though it was freely elected. I have to say that. I was there when Hamas won. So it's very complex, but I just hope people will understand everyone's truth And this is, again, the idea of desire, the desire for understanding otherness. But sometimes I find it almost impossible, because I think everyone, especially in Israel, fights not only for territory, but for faith, for possession, and it's like it's such an ancient struggle. So I don't know. Either everyone will die, or will take somebody like Jesus to come along and change things. That's what I think. But thank you. Yeah. Yes.
A follow-up on the same theme. You alluded to your own experience writing about Israel in a loving way and being disappointed by the responses you got. I'd like to know more about that, and also whether that experience will shape your writing in the future, what you write about, how you write about it.
Yeah, because this is, it's interesting. I have written about Jewish themes, especially the Angel of Memory or Anne Frank. But so that was okay. But to write about Israel was a very unpopular topic, especially because I am seen, again, and this categorization, I think it's crazy and erroneous, as a Latin American poet that wrote against the Pinochet struggle. So they cannot understand why she's writing now about Israel that is so much demonized by the Latin American left. So I am in itself perhaps become a betrayer of a cause. But I will, at first also and I think that we as educators and so many of you as students, we really have to be careful of such biases, because this book was just published about 6 or 7 months, and the reactions were either furious or silent. And I became afraid of this book, and I thought maybe this is a terrible book and I shouldn't read from it. I felt estranged from this. But what has helped me is to read about it, to talk about it, and to share it with people. And then I realized that what I want to say here matters, that I have something important to say. It's a book about love, but love is also political. And I will definitely continue to write. Of course, I would have to be inspired to write about it, but I would like to continue to write about this and not to be persuaded by biased readers and biased critics, and about a very biased academy, because the academy is very much anti-Israel. Look at what happens in the UK. It's frightening. So I am not going to be persuaded that this is not, I cannot judge if it's good poetry, if it's bad poetry. I think it's good poetry, but I think it's beyond poetry, the ideas that I'm trying to convey. And that's why I will pursue writing about this. Yes, thank you. I don't know if there are
questions. Well, thank you. If there are no more questions, I thank you all.